Welcome everyone to the Zoom. My name is Rabbanit Adina Berkowitz. I'm based in New York, and tonight we're going to be looking at Parshat Shmot. And a little bit the topic that I had is, in essence, what does this Parsha teach us about
why can I hear anything?
I would say unconstraining ourselves. It's months away till Pesach, but we're already kind of getting into the Pesach, mode. But the question is, what meaning does this have currently for the situation that Medinat Yisrael's in and Am Yisrael is in? So it's great to be here with you. I'm a scholar in residence at Kol Neshama in New York City. I'm a practicing therapist. And as many of my students know, they call me all Pesach all the time because I edited a Passover Haggadah. So once we get to these parshiot, I'm always excited. But Parshat Shmot, of course, what does the word Shmot mean? Ve'ela Shmot B'nei Yisrael, right? These are the names of the children of Israel. And what's interesting about that is it's once again a repetition because we learned all the names of B'nai Israel when? In the prior Parsha, because when Yaakov is giving the blessings to his son in Vayechi, we learn and we hear all the names. So the question is that the rabbis ask and Rashi asks, what is the reason for the repetition of the names? And when we take a look at Parshat Shmot, what's very interesting is those that are named, those that are unnamed, and those that will be named. So that there's importance, as we know, to having a name. But in essence, if we go back, because we have to ask ourselves, what's going to happen? What's going to happen in Parshat Shmot? In just a few of the psukim, right at the beginning of the Parsha, we're going to see that the Jewish people end up enslaved. And the question for us is, wait a second, how did that happen? Because when we take a look at Bereishit, right, beginning from the whole beginning of the Joseph saga through the end of Vayechi, what is it that we see? We see that the Jewish people have done very well in Egypt. It was a very tumultuous ride for Yosef coming into Egypt. And that becomes, I think, symbolic of so much of our history and what B'nai Israel will experience as slaves in Egypt. But if we go back, we see that Yosef was, you know, the golden child, right? The favorite son of his father, which gets him in trouble with his brothers. He gets thrown in that pit. And what we see is a constant theme, certainly with Yosef, of getting put in a pit. Like the depths, there used to be a slogan for ABC Sports, you know, the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. I remember that as a child. And that's Lahavdil, that's kind of Yosef's life. It's just he's at the pinnacle all the time. And then what happens? He ends up really constrained. Because the word Mitzrayim that we'll discuss in a few minutes, when we say min ha-metzar karatika, from out of the depths, I'm in the narrow straits. Certainly for Yosef, that's what happens to him very quickly. He goes from the thrill of victory, he gets thrown in the pit, he gets pulled out of the pit, he gets taken to Egypt, he does very well as this assistant, right, to Potiphar, and then what happens to him? Potiphar's wife accuses him of trying to rape her, and where does he end up? He ends up back in that pit, and he'll then be pulled out of the pit, and then we know, what is he going to do to his brothers? He's going to create a whole scenario where they're going to experience some of that pit-like experience, right? And it becomes then really a metaphor for what we'll see, I think, in Shmot, of the experience of the Jewish people throughout history, which is that it's this in, ex, it can be a very extreme sense of belonging that Yaakov, we read twice, it says Vayeshev, like he's settled. He's like settled in Egypt. And we see that it says that the Jewish people multiply, the Jewish people do very well. Yosef saves Egypt, right? What did Yosef do? Right? Yosef was the one that said, look, during the full years, you better plan for the lean years because otherwise we won't have food. There'll be a massive famine. And he's the one that saves Egypt. And the Jews seem to be doing very well. And yet, when we get to Shemot, the question becomes, what is the reason that first, right off the bat, that we see this repetition and of the names? And there's two answers that's given. One answer that's given is that, you know, we just want to repeat, you know, it's a good idea to always remember, like, where you come from. But the other reason is that because it's a reminder that our ancestors achieved so much, gave so much, not just Yosef, but the rest, who are always the most loyal citizens of any country, right? The Jews, we were told for people, you know, who were living in Germany, the Jews were more German than the Germans. And, you know, what did German Jews who served in World War I, who had the Iron Cross, think? Well, I was ready to give my life for the fatherland, right? I fought, I got this Iron Cross. I'm not going to be touched by this. I'm a loyal citizen, right? And we know how that ended. But here it's the idea that it's not just kind of like, you know, we're the teenagers when you say, oh, you're Bubby, you're Zadie, you're great Bubby, you're great Zadie, came in the kind of roll in your eyes, you know, like a Nachamol again, you're going to tell us this history. The answer is yes. You have to know where you come from, but you have to know. It's not just to know the names. It's to know a legacy. It's to know what they represented and what Yosef represented. And it tells us Yosef dies, his brothers die, and that entire generation. And in verse 7 in Pasuk Zion, right at the beginning of Parshat Vod, it says the children of Israel were fruitful, teemed, increased, and became strong. Very much so, and the land became filled with them. And then we have that iconic line, right? A new king arose over Egypt. A new king came across Egypt that didn't know Joseph. Now, what does that mean? Is that possible? In other words, it's like saying FDR became president and he didn't like know about Herbert Hoover, right? Donald Trump became president. He didn't know in the United States that Barack Obama had been president. It's of course not. It's what I call conscious forgetting. Because for us as Jews, if you've ever read the essay by the late Professor Yosef Yerushalmi, who taught for many years at Columbia, it's called Zachor. It's about that for Jews, remembering things, it's not just like, you know, remembering a recipe. It has cosmic significance. It becomes part of our DNA. It becomes part of our epigenetics. And we've seen through epigenetics, what is it proven? It's proven that these memories, this trauma, it's with us, even if we didn't go through it. You know, so it's like the ultimate, like you think you're born with guilt. This is worse, right? It's much worse than being born with like Jewish guilt. Like you've got that trauma there. You got to process it. It's being proven psychologically. But here, what is this? The trauma is so bad. It's that we consciously want to forget what you contributed. You know, I always think about when the Khmer Rouge, I remember learning this, took over in Cambodia. What was the first thing they did? It's really fascinating. They said, we're declaring like a new year. Right. So we have like, you know, so the years, you know, BCE, CE, right? They said it's not 1975. It's the year zero because everything that happened, it's like lo haya v'lo nivra. It's like it's been X'd out. It's like we're starting anew. It's like we're creating something new. It's very frightening. And that's what we see here. So it's that a new king arose that we want to wipe out the memory of Yosef. We want to wipe out, and by wiping out the memory of Yosef, what does that really mean? Of course, it means we want to wipe out the contributions that the Jews made to Egypt. Now, I have a question to ask you. How do you wipe out the contributions that Jews made to a country, like overnight? And Paro was very successful. We've seen in the modern era, you know, people always say, oh, you're an anti-Semite. You want to boycott what Jews did? Okay, we'll start telling, we'll take away things that we've done, like the polio vaccine, you know, the Big Bang theory. We could come up with all the inventions, all the things that have made, you know, technology developed in Israel, et cetera. You'll see how you can't manage without us. But the truth is that the Paro had to turn the people. He had to convince the people. People, Egyptians were living next to Jews. They had beautiful relations. How do you convince people overnight? They're a fifth column. They're no good. By the very language that we see again and again, we'll see it's, we saw it previously. It says the Jews were so numerous, right? But here, it becomes to our negative. He says they're more numerous and stronger than us. We better outsmart them. Why? What's going to happen? They're going to want to rebel against us. They're going to want to take over, right? Jews are going to replace us. Does this sound familiar, right? Well, the roots of what we see today have its roots going back thousands of years. But in essence, Paro had to use like the TikTok of his generation to turn the population against Jews that were more Egyptian than the Egyptians. Let's face it, right? And he says, you see, they're not loyal. They're going to turn on us. And of course, what does he come up with? Because he says we better kill the male babies, because what happens to male babies? Male babies grow up into male adults, and male adults serve in armies, and they're going to take over. Now, you know, historically, historians, archaeologists, they try to identify what was going on here, right? So that at that time in Egypt, it seems that the Hyksos that were pro-Jewish were like driven out, and that this new pharaoh came in. And what's fascinating also is that so far, when we don't know right here, what is the name of this pharaoh? We learn that he built storage, that storage cities were built by when the Jews were enslaved, right? Pitom and Ramses. I remember as a kid that there was a hearing that there was an international incident that affected the Camp David Accords that President Carter had made together with Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin, a blessed memory, right? So at one point, Menachem Begin is having, they're having further negotiations, like ladder negotiations. And where do the negotiations take place, right? It takes place in the foot of the pyramids. And Menachem Begin, what does he say to Anwar Sadat? He said, wow, it's such an overwhelming experience to be in the shadow of the pyramids that my people built as slaves. Well, do you know what happened? The whole accords nearly fell apart. Sadat went crazy. What do you mean? What do you mean the Jews built the pyramids? What do you mean the Jews were enslaved? Like, you know, don't rub it in. So they had to figure out how to sort of, you know, gloss over that. But we know from Aramisora, the Egyptians enslaved the children of Israel with terrible harshness and had to turn the population. It's so frightening, because when we take a look at what's going on in our current world, right, you say to yourself, okay, look, let's face it. We always knew that there's anti-Semitism. We always knew, you know, in America, they take polls. It's like a 10 to 15% group of people who don't like Jews. But this war breaks out, and all of a sudden, oh my gosh, it's not the riffraff. It's the smartest people that are coming against us. It's the head of the law review at Harvard that's trying to beat up on Jewish students. And we saw with the university president. I mean, you wouldn't think it would be controversial to say you're against genocide for Jews, that's not a term that you should be allowed to say. But again, somehow the people in Egypt, like overnight, they were able to be convinced that the Jews represented some type of fifth column, and they have to be enslaved. And what we see in the Torah is, as the Jewish people are in such dire straits. They're in such narrow straits. That's what Mitzrayim is about. Who are the heroes that emerge? And that, I think, is like the important, one of the important lessons that we learn, that it could sort of get lost because there's so much going on in the Parsha. And that is that the king of Egypt, he turns to the midwives, right? He turns to Shifra and Pua, and he says, what do you, you, as soon as like you're helping the Jewish women deliver, kill the babies. And what do they say? No, before we come, they've given birth. Like they just sort of pop out. Now, as a matter just of like background, Shifra and Pua were not the only midwives. I mean, two women obviously could not, deal with this. It was more like a guild. It was more like that there was the Shifra Guild and the Pua Guild, and there were a lot of women operating under them. And the commentators, the Mefarshim, say something very interesting, that they said the other midwives that were helping them were not only Jewish midwives, but what we would today, with the term that was coined from the Holocaust of Chassidei Umot HaOlam, righteous Gentiles, who also had some Egyptian women who said, we're with you, we're going to help you. That, by the way, like ruminated on that for a minute, because amidst, when we try to relate to what's going on worldwide, it seems like the whole world's against Israel. But that's not exactly true. I mean, thank God President Biden in America has been very good. Okay, the Europeans have kind of gone back and forth. They were sort of there. They reneged a little. I'm not that familiar, like for people who are in Canada. I think he, right, the prime minister, like, was supportive, then made a bad statement. But the bottom line is, yes, we've lost the TikTok is a big problem. We know that. But it's mostly from ignorance. It's also, unfortunately, the algorithms, that the pro-Israel stuff gets pushed to the side while the pro-Hamas stuff gets sort of promoted, and it's whitewashed and a lot of untruths. But there are people who support Israel who aren't Jewish. There are. I've actually met them. I've met some of them. But it's a problem. But one way to kind of pull ourselves out of it is that there are righteous Gentiles. There are people who are fighting for us. And we've seen like these victories, small victories. I can tell you in New York, like one of the most incredible voices in support of Israel is Congressman Richie Torres, who is Dominican, and he said he had no connection with Israel whatsoever. It just so happened that when he was on the New York City City Council, the Jewish Community Relations Council took him on a trip to Israel that changed his life. And he's part of like the progressive squad. He's a very progressive Democrat. He himself is gay. He's a person of color. It's really something else. And he's so there for Israel. Even the senator from Pennsylvania, like he was part of the squad, Fetterman, and he's become a very, so, there are people out there. And I say that because we see that in the Torah. We know that not all the Egyptians, like the rabbis say, some of the women, they joined in. They spoke up, unlike the massive silence of so many of the women's organizations today. These Egyptian women decided to go on the side of good and the side of right and help Shifra and Pua. And Shifra and Pua, just to, if you take a step back, what's interesting about it is that it's the first example of civil disobedience. They are willing to stand up for what's right. And I think that's so important because you see the difference that just what two people can do, that they, it has that ripple effect. It's not, you don't need an army always of 100,000 people to affect change. I mean, Israel, obviously, it's a different ballgame today for the worldwide Jewish community because we have a state of Israel and we have a standing army. But you have people, one person can change the destiny. We look at the history of the Holocaust. Think about how Raoul Wallenberg, what he did, how he changed the destiny, of saving something like 100,000, 150,000 Hungarian Jews. He came forward. He himself suffered and was imprisoned and died probably in the 1970s in the Gulag. But look at what one person did. So it's a reminder that when we feel so defeated and so down and so much like we're in that pit, we're going to get pulled out. And we've seen that in this whole situation since October 7th, that the worldwide Jewish community has really come together. I'm not saying everybody in the Jewish community is supportive of Israel, but the amount of unity that we've seen, it should never that be that a tragedy of this sort has to take place. But the unity in America, I hope in Canada, certainly in Israel, that people have come together. I'll give you one example. There's an organization in Israel called Brothers and Sisters in Arms. That was the leading group of the high-tech people who were organizing these huge rallies that were against the judicial reform that were taking place every Saturday night for months. A quarter of a million people were coming. As soon as October 7th hit, those same high-tech people said, we're obviously dropping that, we're retooling, and we're going to take all of our technology, and we're going to set up a system to help people. We've got to get restaurants, we have to get food, etc. And one of the interesting things is who joined up with them. Who joined up with him was a guy, a Haredi guy, who had made Aliyah like 2 years ago from Borough Park. And he said, I can't stand what they stood for. I was for judicial reform. But he said, we have to work together. The only way to get out of this pit, out of this bore, out of these constraints is you're going to put aside and we're going to work. And he helped organize all these Haredi women who formed phone banks. And he said, these are now my brothers and sisters. And they said, this is now our brother. We feel that connection. And then obviously that means that when this horror at some point, please God, will be over and hopefully be over soon successfully, it means that people were formerly hated each other, sinna, like the brothers. Brothers who hated each other can figure out a way to get together, and it shouldn't only be a tragedy. So that gives us, I think that gives us hope. When we look then at the story, right, that then Paro says that, you know, all the male child should be thrown in, but the women can be kept alive. We come then to the iconic story of Moshe, right? How is Moses, you know, the Midrash tells us that Amram and Yocheved, his parents, were not named here. They had, Miriam was already born and Aaron was already born. And it was Miriam who saw that her parents got divorced because they said, what's the point of remaining married? We can't have any more children. She went to them and she said, you know, you're worse than Paro. She had a good mouth in her. What kind of way is that to talk to your parents? But she said, you're worse than Paro. He decreed against the male children by getting divorced, and that you have a 50% chance that you could have a girl. So, and you look at the terrible impact you've had on everyone else. Get married. So they remarry. And of course, Moshe's born. Okay. It was not a girl. It was a male. So they are able to keep him. And we know what happens. By the time he's 3 months old, they can't keep him anymore. So they put him in the teva. And of course, that language, right, is very, very interesting, right? Because where was the last time we saw the word teva? When the world was almost destroyed. To me, it's that symbol that the idea that they have to save their child in the water, it's like a world is about to be destroyed if that child's going to die, right? But the way the Teva saved Noah, hopefully it'll save Moshe. And linguistically, it's very interesting what happened, because the Torah tells us that Miriam, like, stays at a distance, like kind of in the marsh, and moves along because she wants to make sure that it doesn't overturn. And who is going to find him? Who is bathing right in the Nile? Paro's daughter. And right now, once again, we don't have yet the name of Paro's daughter. And I think it's also because of this idea that in essence, it's not just limited to Paro's daughter. It means that every one of us could have had the capability of saving someone. It's not just because she is the least likely candidate to save a Hebrew child. Am I right? Her father's Paro is decreed. Talk about getting cut out of the inheritance. And by the way, a number of years ago, about, I think about 15 years ago in New York at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, they had a exhibit of a like hieroglyphics that had been like on loan from Egypt. And I cannot pronounce the name of the female pharaoh, Anant, someone, Ruth Shane is verbalizing it, right? But Asen, nothing, but I can't pronounce it. I'm sorry. Well, what's very interesting is that her legacy was literally, her name was crossed out. It was crossed out. And there's a theory, who was she? That after Paro dies, right, in the Red Sea, the Sea of Reeds, who takes over? Remember, his firstborn son is killed. Who was the one to take over? Her. She's like the first female, but they don't like her. Why not? It's Bithya. What was Bithya known for? Saving the Jews. So they literally X her out. Somehow they were able to figure it out through, you know, carbon dating, whatever, you know, the high tech lasers, right, whatever they use. They were able to make out the name, but they literally scratched her name out. So it wasn't only Yosef. Vayakam el chadash asher lo yadat Yosef. It was her. It's very interesting. But here, she takes pity on him. And what does it say? She opens it and she says, she sees him. And it says in the Hebrew, who is the him? It says, but avatira ehu et hayeled, right? So she sees Moshe, the yeled. And then it says, v'hinei na'ar bocha. So she sees, opens it up. And she sees the boy, and behold, the youth was crying. What? That doesn't, so why is he, why is Moshe being called a Yelid and being called a Na'ar? So there's a very interesting theory about this, is that what really was going on is that it wasn't only Miriam that was standing on the banks of the Nile watching what was going on. It was also Aharon. It was also Moshe's big brother. And when Aharon sees what's going on, v'ha Na'ar bocheh, Aharon is crying. Aharon has tears of empathy. And that's another way that when we're in difficult situations, it's important for people around to be empathetic. That's what you want to feel. You want to feel that it's not sympathy. It's not like I feel for you, but empathy is more like I'm willing to go into the pit with you until to help you get you out, to feel your pain. So we see who the sister and who the brother of Moshe were. They're incredible role models. They're proactive, but they also have that empathy. They feel Moshe's pain. And the Torah tells us something very interesting, right? She says, this is one of the Hebrew boys, right? And what does the Torah tell us? It tells us the maidens, like her lady, you know, her ladies in waiting are with her. What does this mean? It means that everybody is in on it. It's not just Bithya. It's the women around her who have to also swear to secrecy that they're not going to rat out her and they're not going to run to Paro and say, you know, your daughter's harboring a Hebrew baby. It's really quite something. I thought of like the example. It was Prince Philip's mother who was married to royalty in Greece. I don't know if you know this story. And she was safe in Greece. Like the Germans didn't touch her, even though she was British. She was harboring a Jewish family in the basement of her house. She saved a Jewish family. Can you imagine? That's why she was later honored as one of the righteous Gentiles. She happens to be buried in Jerusalem. She became like a nun after her husband was like some kind of royalty in Greece died. And at some point when Prince Charles went to Israel, he went to visit his grandmother's grave in Israel. But that's what I'm saying. This is unbelievable. It wasn't only Bithya. It was the women around her. And of course we know that, you know, the daughter of Paro says, okay, get one of the Hebrew women. And that's how Yocheved ends up being able to nurse her own child. The other thing that we learn here, which is also, I think, so important, and that's something that it's also what's animating so much of, I think, the pain, in particular for Jews who are very progressive and been involved in every progressive movement, whether it's involving LGBT, whether it's involving Black Lives Matter, whether it's climate change, or any of the, women's organizations, you could go down the list. Because here, what do we see? We see that Bitya names Moshe what? She gives him the Egyptian name Monios, okay, which means that he was drawn from the water. And there's this very interesting idea that when we see at the Passover Seder, where we talk about B'yad Chazakah B'zroa Netuyah, that God like saved the Jewish people, what Maimonides doesn't like of these anthropomorphisms, like with an outstretched arm. It tells us, though, that when Bitya sees him in the water, she literally, it says, she extends her arm. Like her arm is like this unusual extension, and one of the medieval rabbis said that at the Seder, when we have the steps of the Seder, right, we have Kadesh Orchatz, right before we dip the parsley, potato, and the salt water, right, we ritually wash our hands, but we don't make the bracha. Goes back to when you had like fruits or vegetables touching water during the time of the Beit HaMikdash, and impurity, should you make the bracha, don't make a bracha. So at the Seder, we don't make the bracha, but when do we make the bracha? We make the bracha later when we have rachatza, right? Now, rachatza, why we have kadesh orchas, karpas yachas, right? Right? Magid, rachatza. Why don't we call it orchas again, right? So the rabbis identify that washing is to remind us of whom? Of actually Bitya. Because she got her hands wet. It's a really beautiful idea in pulling Moshe out. But here's the thing that, to go back to this idea about what a lot of people are going through, is that Moshe had a Hebrew name. His parents didn't call him Moshe, right? Right? So he must have had a bris milah. He gets a Hebrew name. But what is he known as? He's known as Moshe. Now, very often, sometimes, you'll meet Baalei Tshuva, and like their name is like Stanley. Their name is, Mark. They become a Baal Tshuva. You haven't seen them in years. It goes, Stanley, Mark, how are you? Excuse me. My name is Shlomo, right? My name is Menashe. Okay, when I knew you back in high school, you were Stanley, you were Mark. They. I understand it. You sort of have identified it, like you have a new identity. But here, Moshe is known by his Egyptian name. Why? Because of that theme of Hakarat HaTov. Hakara Satov, because for his whole life, who's he going to have gratitude to? To her, for saving him. And that's what's very painful, that when you see that we help other people, when we extend our hand, when we're always there for other people, but in our moment of strife, what happens? They're not there for us. They don't have that gratitude. They don't have that Hakara Satov. That is the most important thing. Gratitude. Gratitude is something that when you're grateful to someone, that's like the best blessing you can have. In fact, when you take a look at our tefillot, it's very interesting that when we have the repetition of the Amida, there's only one prayer that when the Amida is repeated, that everybody has to repeat in a slightly different version. What is that? It's the Modim prayer. It's where we give thanks, because they say, you know what? You can't parcel out thanks. It's not something that you can like give to an agent to do for you, meaning the Shliach Tzibor, the person leading the prayer. You always have to have gratitude for yourself. And when it comes, even if you said it first, you got to repeat it. Okay, so that we see that here, that eternally he'll have gratitude. And of course, we know when that the Nile itself, the Midrash, will teach us that when it comes time of the first plague of Dam, right, it's Aaron that does it. And why does it Moshe do
it? I'm listening. I'm yeah, concentrating.
Because he says that.
Did you win? Did you get any?
None.
How much did they go for?
I don't know how. I can't seem to put anybody on
the last
Zoom.
Second.
But someone has to mute themselves, please. I'm trying to figure out how to do it.
At least it's not hundreds.
That's enough. I don't know. I mean, I can, I'll look, but I dropped out.
Ethan Altman, please mute.
You should know.
Ethan Altman, please mute.
Thank you. I can't seem to get it, anyway. Yeah. But in any event, that idea, he said, I can't turn on the Nile because I have gratitude. It saved my life. These are things that we might just sort of miss. But this is really, it's really something else. And then we see in this parsha also what is among the most difficult experiences that the Jewish people had, which is that when you can't count on each other, when we don't have that sense of unity, we know that the second Beit HaMikdash, the second temple in Jerusalem, was destroyed because of sinas chinam, because of hatred, of baseless enmity and hatred among Jews. Unfortunately, before October 7th, we saw this in Israel. It was just impossible what was going on. And the hatred, the enmity, etc., the sinna, as I said, like the brothers of Yosef. And we'll see this in a minute. But here it tells us that two interesting things about Moshe. In verse 10, right, it says, Vayigdal hayeled, that he grew up, right? Meaning he became a man. And then in verse 11, it says, Vayehi bayamim hahein vayigdal Moshe. Okay, so first of all, whenever you see the word Vayehi, it's that, did you ever see, remember as a kid seeing that iconic movie Jaws? Right, right. Just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, and it's like that music plays in my ear, and it's like a terrible Rorschach test. Like, oh my gosh, what's gonna happen? So lahavdil in the Torah, whenever you see the word vayihi, it's not always good news. We see that, of course, in the Purim Megillah. You know. Vayihi b'mei Achashverosh, right? So it's a indication that there's going to be turmoil coming. But it says, Vayihi b'mei v'gadal Moshe, but we already told he grew up. So they said, the next line says, Vayetse el Echav. It happened in those days that he grows up and he goes to his brethren. He never forgot the Pintaliv. He never forgot who he was. He was maybe like a hidden child. It's like you're hidden, like during the Holocaust. But he never forgot that he was actually Jewish. He was maybe living externally as an Egyptian, but he was like a converso inside. And he's waiting for that moment to say, I have to reconnect with my people. And what does he see? It says, Vayirah bislotam. He sees their suffering. He sees what's going on. What I myself have personally experienced of people who have been so disconnected from their Jewish identity. It's not that they were alienated, they had a bad experience. It's that they had no experience. Like being Jewish was like number 25 on their list. Okay, I like brisket. Who doesn't like a good bagel? But what does that get you? You don't, like as they say, you don't have to be Jewish to love Levi's rye bread. It's like an old advertisement, right? You don't have to be Jewish to love brisket. I've met people that I've taught who said, I didn't know being Jewish was so incidental to my life. And then this happened. And then I saw terrible anti-Semitism directed at me. And it woke me up. And I had to, Vayetse el Achav. I have to now be with my people. I have to go to a synagogue. I have to go to a temple. I have to take a Torah class. I had someone who sat in a Torah class. He said, he's close to 30. He said, I don't know the Bible. I don't even know anything, right? His father is not Jewish. He had no experience, really. Maybe a little Hanukkah. That's it. But that's it. And that's what we see here. And what does he see? He sees their burdens and he sees a Jewish man being beaten by the Egyptian, right? By the Egyptian overseer. And the language of the Torah is so evocative because it says, Vayifen kovacho. He looks here, he looks there. Vayar ki ein ish. He sees that there's no person. Now, of course, Are there people watching this? Of course there are. But Jews are not going to intervene because you're going to get killed. You yourself are a slave. They talk about this, a psychological sort of description of it is called the bystander effect. It had its roots. Part of the theory has been, this part has been disproven, but back in the mid 1960s, there was a famous case of Kitty Genovese in New York and Queens, who was like repeatedly raped. She was screaming help, help. And the sort of urban myth was that no one got involved. No one came to her aid. 50 years later, about 5 or 10 years ago, they revisited, they went back to look at the news stories, and it turned out that the people that lived in the apartment buildings that heard her screaming, there was one or two people called the police. But what happened was they interviewed people in the building, and one man, when they said, did you hear her screaming for help? He said, I did. So they said, well, what did you do? He said, nothing. So they said, why did you do nothing? And he said, because I didn't want to get involved. And that became the prototypical story of like heartless New Yorkers, people in urban areas. I don't want to get involved. Like, what's the big deal to call the police? You know, you can call anonymously. But the psychologists that observe what the bystander effect is that very often when something is happening and lots of people are watching, what happens? No one gets involved because they're sort of psychologically waiting for the next person. So they say the way that you overcome the bystander effect is that if one person screams out, call 911, then 20 people could end up calling 911. Or you point to a person and say, you, call 911. Call the police. Anybody here know how to resuscitate someone? Things like that. But otherwise people just stand around. They don't get involved. Here we see in the Torah, that's the thing. No one's getting involved. They're not going to risk their lives. Moshe gets involved, right? And what does he do? He strikes down the Egyptian, buries him in the sand. The next day, what happens? Jew versus Jew. He sees now two Jews fighting. And he says to the one who started it, like, why did you start this fight? And what does that Jewish person say? Who appointed you ruler over us? What are you going to do? You're going to murder me like you murdered the Egyptian? What does that tell us? It tells us that everybody knew what happened. And if all the Jews knew what happened, who's going to know very quickly? Paro and the whole establishment in Egypt. And that's how Moshe has to run. But that part of the story is, I think, it's a bitter pill to swallow, because it's a reminder that there's nothing worse than when we turn on each other, and that when we have that internal fighting of Jew versus Jew, it's going to be even worse than Jews versus the rest of the world. And we saw that what was going on in Israel. It was so painful to see Jews turning on Jews, and yet through this tragedy, like, so much is upended. You know, I'll tell you an interesting story I read. It was posted last week. A guy who, very, very secular, ran out of gas on a Friday afternoon. And he's like holding up a sign. Can someone stop and help me? No one stops to help him. It's in Israel. And all of a sudden, a Haredi, fervently Orthodox, you know, like black-hatted guy, stops and says, what's the matter? He says, I don't have gas. I'm trying to get help. So the Haredi man says, look, there's a gas station about 5 miles from here. Wait, don't leave. I'll go get a can of, you know, of petrol, and I'll come back. And that's what he does. He comes back and he fills up the car. The Chiloni guy, the secular guy, says, you know, I've been standing here for over an hour. No one came to help me. You came to help me. He said, but I'm very embarrassed about something. So he says, well, what are you embarrassed about? He says, I want to show you something that I have as a bumper sticker on the back of my car. So he takes the Haredi guy, and the bumper sticker is like a very kind of crude slogan that basically means like, down with all the religious people. They're horrible. I hate them. Something like that. So he says, I'm peeling it off right now. And he says, what do I owe you for the gas? So the Haredi guy says, you don't owe me anything for the gas. He says, no, I want to reimburse. He says, no, it's Erev Shabbos. This is my mitzvah. So he says, well, how can I repay you? So he says, you know what? Would you like to learn a little something about Judaism? So the guy says, fine, I'm open to that. So they become like Zoom friends. And then this happened the end of last August. The Chilani guy says, you know, the learning has been very nice, but he says, you know, I've actually never spent Shabbat in the house of somebody who is religious. He says, do you think I could come for Shabbat with your family? So this guy lived in Bnei Brak. So he says, okay, let me figure it out. Let me talk to my wife. We'll figure it out. Well, he doesn't call his wife, but he calls his rabbi. And he says, you know, I don't know what to do, because when should I tell him to come? Like, he's eager to come. This is like a very beautiful opportunity for him to bring his family, but it's going to be Rosh Hashanah. So I can't bring him for Rosh Hashanah, because that's too much. And I can't bring him for Yom Kippur. And like Sukkot, so I don't know what to do. So his rabbi says, well, bring him for Simchas Torah. He goes, no, but I can't bring him for Simchas Torah, because our entire family goes to visit my father, who's older. So this Haredi man's rabbi says, look, for this year, do it differently. Have everybody come to your house. Have your brothers, you know, the siblings come, and tell your father to leave his house and come. And it'll be like a different kind of Simchas Torah for everyone. So he says, okay, you're the rabbi. I asked you a question. Fine, I'll do it. And of course, you know how this story ends. The story ends that the elderly father lived in Sderot, and the man who needed the gasoline that ended up coming for Simchas Torah to this Haredi family in Bnei Brak lived in Kibbutz Be'eri. So it's mind boggling. It's mind boggling when we think, you know, amidst all of the terrible stories of the way that through something so incidental, the Jewish history for this family, there's a future. It's really mind boggling. So that when we see that Jew versus Jew, we got to figure out how to keep these warm feelings going, and that we don't immediately fall back into the old patterns. We know that in this parsha, Moshe, you know, will end up in Midian, and of course, he'll meet Yitro. And Yitro is a very interesting thing, because here too, what kind of gratitude do we have to Jethro, to Yitro? He gets a parsha named after him, somebody not Jewish, because of the good he did. And we find like the Medrash, there's an incredible Medrash in the Talmud that talks about, you know, the three people, the prophet, right? The prophet Bilam, Eov, Job, and Yitro. And that they, the way this Medrash is written is that Paro consulted with them, what should he do about the Jews? So Bilam, you know, the one who was supposed to curse, right, the Jews, like he says to Paro, kill them. So that's why Bilam ends up where he ends up. Eov, when he's asked Job, he remains silent. So the strata is kind of, that's why some of his sorrows happened, because he didn't speak up when he could. But what about Yitro, right? The Midian priest, they said, Yitro says to Paro, why are you taking out on the Jews? They're so loyal to you. How could you do this to him? And he says, I'm going to kill Yitro. And Yitro has to flee. So that there's an incredible idea that our heroes are not only Jewish people. We see that in this parsha. We see it at Bitya and the women around. And we certainly see it. We certainly see it with Yitro. The thing just that I want to conclude with is the two themes that we'll see again and again in the Torah, right? So first, Moshe is always going to be somewhat that reluctant prophet, right? He's at the burning bush. He's called to that. He is going to be, you know, the liberator of the Jewish people. And what does he say? Pick someone else. Why me? Right? Who am I to go that I should take them out? And he says, you know, what am I supposed to say? How's anybody going to know, like, who am I to represent it, right? So we see immediately the promise that God makes to Moshe that the Jewish people will be redeemed, and that's very important. But the second thing is that Moshe is sublimates his own ego. This is not something in essence that, you know, he was born to be the liberator. He kind of gets dragged into it, and that affects often his attitude. But the second thing is that, it ends up that, the Jewish people's lot when Moshe, right, ends up coming to Paro, the lot of the Jewish people become worse because Paro takes away the straw, right? And what becomes then the nature of the relationship between the Jewish people, right, enslaved with Moshe? Complainers. Have you ever been on a Pesach program? I never want to run a Pesach program. I just want to be in a Pesach program because the complaints are endless, right? There's a site that reviews like all the great kosher restaurants. You can't believe the complaints that people have. It's endless, right? So part of that epigenetics about complaining, I don't mean to make light because it's understandable. Jews were enslaved. It was terrible. But we begin to see this pattern that Moshe is going to have to live with for the rest of his life, which is like, you've made things worse for us. How is this helping us? And that's, I think, the other key thing when we're in such a state of despair, that you can never despair. You have to always, that we have to always figure out how to manage in the worst of circumstances. That's also part of our legacy, because when you enter into a state of despair and you give up, that is blackness. That's darkness. There's no light there. And what we see here is that eventually B'nai Israel will be liberated, and eventually will be liberated by Moshe. But to me, the most magnificent thing about this Parsha and the Parshiot that follows is that this is not just ancient history. This is not like learning about the Aztecs or learning something. It's a connection we should all feel, because the themes, the reactions, the history we find here, it keeps repeating itself over and over, and it's what we're living with. So that we always have to have that faith in God, that faith in Hashem, but we also have to be proactive. It's not that we just say, okay, Hashem, save me from this terrible storm. I'm not going to put on boots. I'm not going to evacuate, as they say, because I believe in you. That's foolish. But nonetheless, what we see here is that you have to have faith, and you can never doubt the impact that comes back to right to the beginning, the impact that one person can have on our history. Whether it was Shifrin Pua, whether it was Bitya, whether it was Moshe Rabbeinu, whether it was Miriam, whether it was Aaron, each of them had such an impact that it shouldn't take after they die that we say, oh, you know, what they meant to us, right? Because we know that happens with Miriam. It's only after she dies, what happens? She carried the water, right? Without her, what are we going to do? So that we always have to have the Hakara Satov, and the best way to have that gratitude is while the people are still there. And let's really pray that that the sense of unity we have, that after the Tzarot are over, we'll figure out how to maintain them and be able to go forward. So I wish everybody a happy, as my Chabad friends say, a happy fiscal new year. It should just be a year of health and safety and security for Israel and for our Chayalim and Chayalot and for all of us living in the diaspora. So, and a wonderful Shabbat Shalom to everyone. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you so much. Have a good job.
Thank you for a very powerful, powerful and insightful and inspiring talk. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone. Okay.
Thank you. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you.